Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, a show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. This week, we continue with part two of our coverage of CityLab Paris.
Simply by reframing the question, we suddenly spoke to a market that could deliver on that, whereas before the city ran the same $20 million procurement over and over again and no one responded because the question was not right for the market.
We create a lot of positive stories of people that are insanely motivated and really eager to get working and really act as a counter-narrative to this idea of the people coming and sitting on the German state funds.
I did clinical practice in the past, but the real appeal of public health is that you can have a very large population impact. So you can impact the lives of literally millions of people.
You've got to tolerate a Brexit. You've got to tolerate a Trump train. You've got to tolerate the Bernie Sanders movement, Black Lives Matter. All these folks who are bluntly, sometimes impolitely, knocking over the status quo.
More and more cities around the world are starting to think and act global, as Paris's mayor Anne Hidalgo declared on the opening day. So how can we better deliver change around the globe? Join us over the next 30 minutes for the final installment of our coverage of CityLab. That's coming up right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. It's not difficult to identify what works and what doesn't in a city. The challenge usually lies in how to tackle it, from budget constraints to the system to the "it's always been done this way" approach. But sometimes all it takes is for someone to rephrase the question so it reaches more people. At least that's the belief of Sasha Hasselmeier, the social entrepreneur behind CityMart, a platform connecting cities around the world to a global network of solutions and people. He told me about his way of easing the pressure on cities and how he's trying to help solve some of those tricky problems.
So the first thing is that we're trying to solve a really big problem. 10% of world GDP, of the entire economy, is spent by local governments, by city governments, that are procuring goods and services. So an average city will deliver about 800 to 2,000 public services. And what we found is that decisions around what these services are really poorly informed, which means that today a solution that is proven to be effective and cost-saving in one city will take 40 years at least to reach just 1% of population in other cities. So we're trying to accelerate that. We're trying to turn those 40 years into months. And we do that by providing a technology platform that basically gives every city employee insights into all the possible solutions to achieve better results in their communities.
So you're a private company and you charge people, I presume, for your services. So when you go to see a city mayor or city hall, what is it you can offer them for the fee that they're going to pay you? Is it efficiency? Is it bottom line? Is it putting money back into their coffers?
So that's been, as an entrepreneur, that's one of the hardest things to figure out is, and at the end of the day, we found that it's public good. Right. So cost saving, whilst that is important, it is not a driving force in government in and of itself. It is really showing that there are better outcomes you can achieve with lesser or very different types of funding. And so we've been over the last 6 years, we've been able to bring down the cost of any transaction a city does with us by more than 95%. So we're focusing both on making this really radically more accessible, but also on focusing on what is the return on investment. And the return on investment is achieving better quality services, but also changing the work culture inside government to be more citizen and problem focused.
So we have this platform that allows people to exchange ideas and best practice. And I know that you help train people how to get the most out of that. But give us a real life example of how you've come into play in one of these city halls and affected change?
Every story is different, but all of them are in some way the same. So a good example is Philadelphia came to us with an idea to tackle traffic fatalities. It's a really huge issue in the city and has been for decades. It's achieving much poorer results than other cities of its size. And their goal was really to think differently about allocating about $5 to $10 million a year to make the streets safer. And traditionally, their spending was on infrastructure, on building things in the streets. And they thought maybe there's some technological intervention we can do. What they found working with us was that actually the really promising solutions to this issue start by asking questions about traffic behavior. And it occurred to the city after 10 years of spending millions and millions of dollars they have never understood why people behave the way they behave. So they did that by exploring how other cities are tackling this problem. And in the end, they went to market not with a $10 million procurement to buy stuff to make the street safer, but actually for $32,000, they procured data and analytics about the behavior of people, why they do what they do, what happens when an accident happens, how does that come about, to then target their interventions much better. So oftentimes a city, by working with us and using the tools we offer them, discovers that the question they're asking, the problem they want to solve, is quite different from what they set out to do. And we guide them by learning from other cities, by breaking down the question they're asking in new ways, so that they can really come to an entirely different conclusion at the end of the day.
So in Philadelphia, I've spent my $32,000, and this, I presume this research was shaped or existed within a university environment. Now, I know that people say Crossroad because they have their headphones on, or that they don't see enough warning lights, whatever. But then I go out and do the procurement afterwards, do I? Is it shaping that procurement, or was that almost enough to start changing policy on its own?
That on its own has changed policy and will change policy going forward for quite some time, because it really is a game changer in the way the engineering of the city defines what it's doing. It's really suddenly introduced a factor into this, which was, oh, actually, this is why things happen and this is how things happen. And in other cases, we have procured the streetlight upgrade in San Francisco, and the city wanted to have a streetlight upgrade, LED street lighting, to save energy largely. And someone discovered, well, maybe we could also put other wireless control system into these streetlights. And it turned out that none of the manufacturers of streetlights could offer wireless control systems that work for other urban services. The reason why that interested them to start with was that a department wanted to put their antennas on top of every streetlight to control something called shot spotter, to detect where gunshots are fired from, to control smart parking meters, electricity meters, all kinds of things. And they all have their own network. And someone said, oh, that would be really ugly. Why don't we just ask for one antenna? And it turned out that none of the big lighting manufacturers had a solution. So they came to us, and again, we reframed the problem. The problem was not to buy a streetlight with an antenna on it, but was actually to buy a universal wireless control system for the city that could also turn the lights on and off. And simply by reframing the question, we suddenly spoke to a market that was, there were startups, there were really exciting technology companies that could deliver on that. Whereas before, the city ran the same $20 million procurement over and over again, and no one responded because the question was not right for the market.
And finally, how do you get received around the world, and how do mayors deal with you? Because for a mayor who's not in the US, for example, who starts procuring a service from an American company to come in and tell them how to run their city hall, do they have to find a way of explaining that to their constituents? Because I presume that some people say, why don't you know how to empty the bins? Or why do you not know why people are being run over? I can tell you.
This is a brilliant question and comes right to many of the issues we're trying to deal with. I think when we started out CityMart, we had an observation that it was taken for granted that public procurement should be spent locally, and that innovation meant really reinventing the wheel locally. And in a world where you have 500,000 city governments spending 10% of GDP, that is just simply too costly as an explanation for everything. So, for example, Stockholm spent millions and millions of dollars reinventing a parking system that they could have imported for $30,000 from Tallinn in Estonia, 25 minutes away. It would have taken 3 months to deploy the solution. Instead, it took them 7 years with a major technology company to build a solution that never really worked. So that is one end of the spectrum where you say, we cannot live off the idea of reinventing everything in a market that has so many shared problems. On the other hand, we found that we need to couple these opportunities for spreading technologies and solutions across cities with local opportunities. So for us, that's why the indicator of minority and women-owned businesses participating in this, having a chance, are really important. And we work together with mayors and their teams on providing local capacity building side by side with this opening up procurement. And what we found is that the best transactions are the ones where we had, for example, a local small business use our data to find a technology partner from outside, and together they offered a really compelling solution, right? They took the best things of the solutions that scale together with their local knowledge and local insight and their real interest in solving something. And that made it really, really different. And another part is that companies are usually still mobile. To sell to city governments, if you're an innovator, is 4 times more expensive than in any other industry. This is like the hardest market to break into. But the entrepreneurs are probably more committed than anywhere else. They really want to solve these problems, and they're willing to be amazing partners to government. It's a very different quality of relationship that we see unfolding than in the kind of traditional large contract. So mayors, I think they like the story of opening procurement because every mayor wants to make procurement more accessible to smaller businesses. They want to create more opportunity. They're tired of the traditional old vendor system and want to diversify that. And at the same time, they want to innovate. They want to see more startups, more cool stuff happening. They're also trying to make sure that this doesn't exclude the groups that are traditionally excluded. And I think this is a very fine line we guide them through, where you can achieve really great results.
That was Sasha Hasselmeier, the CEO and founder of CityMart. How do you define identity, and how does that affect you when what you thought to be true is turned upside down? In the age of Trumps and Brexits, this is a question that's never been asked more frequently. Eric Liu is the founder and CEO of Citizen University, which tries to teach people in the US about the power of citizenship. Decisions are not made by hidden away figures, and if we all vote or rally behind a cause, active change can happen. He told Monocle's Carlotta Rebello how he believes change should be built from the ground up.
Citizen University is a nonprofit, an NGO based in the United States, that all our work is about really trying to democratize understanding of how power works in civic life. So teaching the elements of how you get stuff done and how you insert yourself into the process of decision making wherever it may happen, right? Because the central question of almost all civic power is who decides? And if you were to ask anybody randomly on the street or in the listenership of this program, really, who decides? Who decides on questions of waste management or bus lines or school opening times and closing times? Who decides the structure of our criminal justice system? Who decides whether and when we're going to move to driverless vehicles? All these questions that surround us right now in life in cities are not things that are happening to us like the weather or just falling from the sky. They are the fruits of decision. And so our work at Citizen University is basically know how to insert yourself into the answer to that question, who decides, and to be part of that process of decision.
It's really about raising awareness that you, the public, the person on the streets, you are the one that actually has the power to influence these decisions. As you were saying, it doesn't just happen to you.
That's right. And I think it's so important right now to emphasize this seemingly elementary fact that you have the power of decision in civic life. It's important because we live in a time where I think many people feel utterly powerless. There are great forces afoot in the world, inequality and globalization and nationalism and populism, that can make a lot of people feel, well, what can I do alone as an individual? And I think this is precisely the moment where we are seeing all around the world these bottom-up surges of people power. In the United States, it's been everything from Occupy Wall Street, the Tea Party, $15 Now, Black Lives Matter, all around the world, of course, the different color revolutions, the umbrella revolution in Hong Kong, Brexit. You know, this is not just a progressive or a conservative phenomenon. It's people wanting to upend prior allocations of power and to knock over established institutions. And that's happening all around the world right now. And so I think this is a moment for you to realize, actually, like it or not, this is an age of bottom-up citizen power.
And it also touches upon identity as well, because realizing the power you have that you might not be aware of before unlocks who you really are as well.
That's absolutely right. I think one of the core drivers of the exercise of power in civic life is identity, whether a sense of belonging or a sense of fear or threat to your identity. We're seeing that everywhere around the world right now. We're seeing that in Europe, in the surge of nationalist parties, in the United States, the reemergence of white nationalism. But also, again, the assertion of different communities of identity, like dreamers in the United States, undocumented immigrants who are deciding to step out of the shadows and claim their place in civic life. Black Lives Matter, as I mentioned earlier, this assertion that we can no longer tolerate a status quo in which, in the eyes of police and the criminal justice system, black life is valued less than. right? All of these are assertions of collective power that are bound up with questions of identity. But to really boil it down right now, I think, you know, I define power quite simply as a capacity to ensure that others do as you would like them to do. And to a lot of people, that definition sounds kind of creepy or scary or domineering. But if we're honest about it, we as humans are always trying to get others to do as we'd like them to do. And in civic life, that capacity is applied to questions of common interest and public decision. And of course, identity, collective identity, is going to drive a lot of the exercise of power.
Now, when Brexit at Trump happens, it shakes your system and everything in terms of what you thought your country meant and who you thought you were, going back to the question of identity. Does that really end up being better for you, because it brings people that hadn't questioned those things before to start doing so and actually realizing exactly the potential and power that they do have?
I think you put it really well. From the perspective of, if all you value is order and stability, then you're probably better off if most people remained illiterate in power and most people remained unquestioning about notions of identity and fairness and inequality. But if what you value, in fact, is democracy, if what you value, in fact, is the idea that the complex adaptive ecosystem, which is a free society, is going to have a maximum number of participants who actually feel like they've got a stake in the system, then you've got to tolerate some disorder. You've got to tolerate a Brexit. You've got to tolerate a Trump train. You've got to tolerate the Bernie Sanders movement, Black Lives Matter, all these folks who are bluntly, sometimes impolitely, knocking over the status quo. That's not to say I like all the policy outcomes that come from it, some of these movements, but I think that you've got to recognize that when you have something as disruptive as Brexit or as Trump, it is the system saying something is sick in the body politic. And I'd rather listen to that. I'd rather have the body begin to reckon with the illness of inequality, concentration of wealth, the sense that the game is rigged. I'd rather have that reckoning than not, because at the end of the day, there is no not reckoning, right? Either you're going to confront this head on, or you're going to let the body politic get so diseased that it reaches the point of collapse. And I don't want that. I didn't sign up for that.
That was Eric Liu, founder and CEO of Citizen University, speaking to Carlotta Rabello. If you look back at the defining images of 2015, surely some of them will feature a refugee on a train arriving somewhere in Europe. When the migrant crisis arrived to Germany's doorsteps, services were overwhelmed, and even today they struggle to cope with housing people, finding people jobs, or giving them proper education. That was a premise that led Robert Barr to create Jobs for Refugees, a charitable organisation helping refugees and migrants to find work and traineeships. They also assist with things like language learning and navigating bureaucracy. He told us about how it all started.
We work directly with refugees. We have a platform of 15,000 refugees in Germany and a couple of hundred employers. And what we do is we kind of facilitate the contact and help both sides, first of all, get in contact with each other, but then also help with the managing the whole process of hiring and interviewing and getting to know each other, and really try to make it as comfortable as possible for both sides to kind of even the playing field regarding all those barriers that are in the way.
Now, when those refugees arrived, I happened to be in Munich and just see the vast numbers. We were on a train that arrived in the station, just seeing the quantity of people arriving and seeing that people were obviously from all sorts of different places. It wasn't just Syrian refugees arriving. It was people coming from Afghanistan, from Iraq, even from Pakistan. Many arriving with no German, not with a skill set that was easy to explain to a new employer. Many people had worked in quite manual jobs, I presume, and had to be helped to explain what their skill sets were. How basic is the work that you're having to do? Are you having to help people with their language skills? Are you having to try and find out what people's abilities are? And also, are you having to try and explain to employers that these people, while facing some challenges ahead, need to be looked after and helped?
Well, yes, it was a lot of people coming. At some stages, there were over 2,000 or 3,000 people coming a day to Germany. And regarding their skill sets, they actually find it varies quite a lot regarding of where the people are from. If you look at, for example, the education level that people have in the different origin states they come from, in Iran, there's a lot of educated people. Tomorrow, we'll be speaking on stage with Nastara, and she's from Iran. She now works at PayPal as a solution architect there. But we also cater to refugees that have, I would say, are less qualified, and we place them in production helper jobs or in delivery jobs. And it varies quite regarding to where the people are from. We cater to any kind of skill level. Obviously, language is a big issue because German, as you probably know, is quite a hard language to learn. In the beginning, we were struggling a lot with that. But now people have been here for almost 2 years and it's getting a lot easier. And one also has to say that Germany has really learned out of the experience of the 60s and 70s, where the Gastarbeiter from predominantly Turkey came to Germany, and there were actually very little efforts in terms of integration that were being made, also offering language learning opportunities. And this is something where Germany really has learned, and almost every refugee really has an opportunity to learn German in some way or another, and there's a lot of language courses provided. So we're seeing rapid improvements from the side of the refugee, and from our side, we really consider also taking up work as the last piece in the puzzle there. You learn German a lot faster when you actually engage with locals and engage with Germans, and you do that prominently at the workplace.
We've just had the German elections, where there was lots of debates in German newspapers about the same questions, I guess, that's happening elsewhere, that globalization hasn't helped many people who are local residents, and people have been critical of the numbers of refugees coming to the country. Has it been difficult for you to maintain a positive narrative around all your work as some people in Germany begin to say, okay, we don't want to help all these people, we need to help ourselves?
Well, for the first part of your question, whether we were able to maintain a positive narrative, I would like to think so, yes. I mean, we create a lot of positive stories of people that are insanely motivated and really eager to get working and really act as a counter narrative to this idea of the people coming and sitting on the German state funds and, you know, being kind of lazy on that regards, which is not at all true what we find. I really want to put this in perspective. I mean, we've seen a push to the right, as you said, all over Europe, actually all over the Western Hemisphere. And considering of how big the challenge has been for Germany and how many people came to Germany, the move to the right is rather moderate compared to other countries. I mean, you look at Austria now, where you have the FPÖ and possibly being part of the government, and in France, Marine Le Pen actually having a realistic chance of becoming president. And it's only 70% of the people that were able to vote in Germany. So I wouldn't over-pronounce this fact. And maybe let me add one more thing is, if you look at the German demographic and the aging population in Germany, we really do need those young people coming in and coming into our labor market. And our social welfare system and our state really needs this over the next 50 years.
Now, after 2 years, people still are arriving, but nowhere near on the scale before. Has your job changed as an organization now? Are you now mentoring people who are 2 years into their careers, or who are, I guess, a bit further entrenched into German society? Do you still help those people even after all this time?
Yeah, actually, we find that our job has become easier, as I said earlier, but regarding the language skills, that the people are able to speak the language much better, makes it easier for us. But, I mean, the question of integration, that will be with us for the next 5, 10, 15 years. So even people have stopped coming to Germany in those large quantities as they have in 2015 and beginning of 2016. The real work, the work of integrating the people into our culture, into our society, and also into our labor market, that has just begun.
That was Robert Barr, founder and CEO of Jobs for Refugees. How to make a healthier world is a question not easily answered. With more than half of the world's population living in cities, policies can play a key role in how healthy we all are. From reducing obesity to the providing of healthier food options, or just dropping the rate of smoking in a city, what is the best way to maximise the benefits to public health? To explain all this, Monocle's Carlotta Rebello caught up with Dr. Kelly Henning, the leader of Bloomberg Philanthropy's public health programme. A doctor, she now practices medicine at a citywide level, helping shape public health around the globe. Here she is.
I like to say that I practice public health, so I'm still in practice in a sense. I did clinical practice in the past, but the real appeal of public health is that you can have a very large population impact. So you can impact the lives of literally millions of people. And in practice, you're taking care of one patient at a time. That's very important. But the opportunity to really have large-scale impact, which is what you get with public health policies, was what was so attractive to me. We've seen in the United States and in Mexico and a number of other Latin American countries, for example, very dramatic increases in overweight and in obesity among populations increasing over the last 15 years or so. And what we do notice is a big change in diets during that period. So we find much more processed food, much more advertising of processed food, much more junk food consumption among the young and the very young. And these issues, together with changing lifestyles, have contributed very much to these major increases in overweight and obesity. And it's a problem that we're realizing now really needs action and urgent action. So we're very involved in that issue.
You also do work related to smoking in cities. Now, is it about preventing people from ever starting?
The policies that work to help people quit smoking also work to help young people not start smoking. So these things are very well tried and true. These are policies that have been around for a while and that governments really need to step up on. So things like 100% smoke-free public places, advertising bans, so there's really no advertising of the product, and informing the public about the dangers, and that could be through mass media or through very graphic warnings on packages of tobacco products. And then the really important piece is to raise the price of tobacco products, because if you raise the price, it really decreases particularly young people from picking up tobacco. When Mike Bloomberg was mayor in New York City, he increased the price of tobacco products dramatically. And we've seen teenage smoking rates really decline in New York over the last 10 to 12 years. And they're now in the single digits. So we have 6, 7, 8% of children, teenagers smoking, where it used to be far higher than that. So we really know these strategies work. It's just about getting them implemented and getting them on the books.
Now, both these themes I've talked so far, obesity and smoking, they're both tied up with advertising, the way healthy food products don't have the same sort of branding and advertising as the processed foods, are often more expensive as well. So leading a healthy diet is not for everyone. How do you change that cycle? Because you can't control the message that private companies, private producers, tobacco companies want to send out. So how do you ensure at least that there's a balance and that the other side is being heard?
So there really are opportunities to curtail advertising. Places have done really amazing jobs on this. Some countries even do not allow point-of-sale advertising of tobacco. So if you walk into a store and you wish to buy a package of cigarettes, you actually have to ask for that package. You can't point to it. You can't refer to it on some chart. You can't look at an advertising. Children are not exposed to advertising at that point of sale. This is very, very effective. An increasing number of national governments are really taking this on. In some places, it's hard for cities to do this because they may not have the jurisdiction to actually reduce or to limit advertising. But some cities do. For example, we work a lot with Indonesia, and there's a mayor's alliance in Indonesia of cities, more than 40 cities that work on tobacco control, and a large number of those cities have actually banned tobacco advertising. So it is possible to do it through policy and regulation, but you have to look a little bit at the context to see at which level of government that work can be done.
That was Dr. Kelly Henning, lead of Bloomberg Philanthropy's public health program. And that's all for this week's edition of The Urbanist. The show was produced by Carla Tarabello and it was edited by David Stevens. Tune in on Monday when a brand new edition of Tall Stories comes out. And also remember to subscribe to ensure that you don't miss out on any new episodes. To play you out of this episode of The Urbanist, here's Zaz with Paris sera toujours Paris. Thank you for listening, city lovers. Par précaution, on a beau mettre des croisillons à nos fenêtres, passer au bleu nos devantures et jusqu'aux pneus de nos voitures, désentoiler tous nos musées, chambouler les Champs-Élysées, en noyauté de terre battue, toutes les beautés de nos statues, voler le soir.